and Ahui Ho. Thank you for tuning in to KKCR this afternoon, listening to Shoot and L's Bells, giving you the finest of electro pop and lush and crush and EDM and all kinds of crazy awesome noises from that world. Bebopping, hip hopping, dancing. Stick it down, stick around, stay tuned. We've got Out of the Box coming up in just a moment. And I want to thank so much the underwriters who helped make this show possible, like Kalaheo Chiropractic, Soul Tran, and Ching Young Village. You've got it tuned to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea.
Kalaheo Wellness Center, natural pain relief services, providing gentle chiropractic acupuncture, therapeutic massage, nutritional wellness, postural training, cold laser therapy, and spinal decompression. Open Monday through Friday, now a second location in Kapa'a, 822-0711, or Southside Center at 332-5580, or online at kalaheochiropractic.com.
Lewis and Eddie Soltran Construction, 639-4836, building quality on Kauai for over 25 years. New custom homes, remodeling, and repairs. Exclusive dealer for Talia's Hurricane Roll-Down Shutters Protection for your home. Lewis and Eddie Soltran Construction, 639-4836, or soltranconstruction.com.
Qingyang Shopping Village proudly supports Kauai's community radio by underwriting this program. Qingyang, the heart of Hanalei. Mahalo, Jeff Culverhouse, for your support.
Yes, mahalo, nui loa, indeed. If it weren't for people like that, and people just like you, going to kkcr.org and clicking on the donate button, we would not only survive, but you help make us thrive. So super stoked about all the support from the community. Super stoked for me personally about all the help that I get helping put together this show. Got an interview this afternoon that I recorded yesterday with Josh Thome. He's the director of the new film coming out this weekend, the world premiere, Aina, That Which Feeds Us, which is a beautiful film. If you've had a chance to see the trailer, the promo for it, it's really quite incredible. So talking with Josh about half an hour from now. Coming up right away, we've got Stephanie Senhoff, who is going to be on island next week, talking about some of the GMO and toxicity issues. This is a series of events that have been put together by GMO-Free Kauai. And I believe I've got her on the phone right now. Aloha, Stephanie. Are you there? Can you hear me? Aloha, Stephanie.
Aloha. How are you?
Oh, great. Thank you so much for calling in. Really appreciate you coming to our little island and sharing some of your knowledge and wisdom and your accrued experience. You're a senior research scientist at MIT in the computer science department, the artificial intelligence lab. You've got a degree in biology, specializing in food and nutrition. You've published over 200 peer-reviewed referenced articles in technical journals, and when alarmed by the bloom in autism over the last decade, you really turned your attention to poor nutrition, environmental toxins, and our indoor sedentary lifestyle that seems to have such an impact on these things. Welcome to Kauai, and thanks so much for coming here.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here, and I want to tell you that I have Judy Carman with me here at this phone. She's from Australia. She'll also be talking at the meeting, and she's also an expert. She's an expert on GMO, the issues with GMO foods.
Sure, sure. I was looking at her in also equally impressive CV, PhD in nutrition and metabolism, master in public health and disease and biostatistics. We are certainly blessed to have people of your intellectual and academic caliber here trying to explain to the community what's going on. Are you guys smart enough to make it simple enough for me to understand?
That's always the challenge.
We hope so.
Well, welcome, Judy. I'm pretty sure that's your Aussie voice in the background there.
You picked it, did you?
Yes. So what are you guys going to be doing next week? There's three events. We've got Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday next week in Waimea, Church of the Pacific, and KCC Performing Arts. What are folks going to be, what are you going to be teaching us? What do we have to learn?
Okay, we're going to be doing a tag team. She'll come first and then me. And then she'll cover the GMO angle, and I'll talk about the poisons, the toxic chemicals, especially glyphosate, which is the Roundup, the pervasive herbicide that's used to kill the weeds. I'll let Judy speak a bit about what her topics will be, and then I can tell you something about what I'll talk about.
Okay, great. Then maybe you can explain to us what pervasive means.
Okay, you'll keep us at a really, really low, you know, intellectual. We'll try to keep it simple.
Well, it's my goal, and people will laugh at this, but it's my goal to interrupt you guys and make you explain what you just said in a way that even I can understand it.
So is that a challenge, is it?
Well, you know, they say if you can explain something to, like, a 5 or a 6-year-old, then you really know what you're talking about.
Yeah, that's good. No, I try to explain things very, very simply. So we'll see if I can get through this without you. Give me a grade of 10.
Well, yeah, I'm about as smart as the average 11 or 12-year-old, so I'll try and keep up.
Okay, so yes, we're doing a tag team here. We're doing I go first and talk about GMO safety assessments. So I talk about what GM crops are on the market, how they've been made, why they are genetically modified, and then I talk about the safety assessments that are done by companies, safety assessments that are required by governments, and the sort of the holes you get in the safety assessments, because the holes are really big. And I talk about the sorts of things that haven't been done. For example, there are no tests for reproductive health, for example. You know, how is it going to stop you? Is it going to have an effect on your ability to have children?
Well, does that matter?
Might to some people.
Yeah, maybe so, huh?
Yeah. So if you're wanting to have children, and you know, I'll put it this way: before they start feeding GM crops to a billion people, it's probably a good idea to do some really good quality safety assessments.
You know, I agree with that completely. And if I could ask you to pause for just a moment, this is also a really good idea.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, board, volunteers, or underwriters.
That's right. So please feel free. Are you still there?
Yes. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. No, just go. I didn't mean to disrupt your line of reasoning, but it's important that as we're having this discussion that, you know, that it's clear that our radio station is not taking a position one way or another in these matters, that you are welcome to present your views and me mine and callers theirs, but, you know, it doesn't have any sort of institutional position.
So then I also then talk about what happens if you do proper safety assessments. If you do actually do a proper feeding study on some animals that have been exposed to it for a long time in the United States, which is pigs in a commercial piggery, and you actually measure to see if the GM feed is actually having any effect on them. And we found that there was an effect on pigs in a commercial piggery, because most pigs in the United States now get fed high amounts of GM soy and GM maize, GM corn. And the word on the street from the people who are farming these pigs is that it's having an effect on their health. And so we went and did a study to actually assess that, and we found that there was an increase in the weight of the uterus, which is the womb, of a 25% greater weight.
And what was that? What was causing that?
Well, we don't know, but certainly it was associated with the GM diet. So, in other words, if you were a female pig and you were on the GM diet, your chances were you had a uterus that was 25% higher. Now, there could be a number of reasons for doing that, and they all have medical conditions. They all have long names, and they're all something that women wouldn't want to have.
But it's doing something to the creatures.
Yes.
Now, I saw some pictures on your website.
Yes.
And lit particularly gruesome. Is that an example of some of the results of eating GM food?
And they're some of the results I'll be talking about. So the gruesome pictures you're talking about there are actually of the inside of the stomach of these pigs. And normally the inside of the stomach of a pig should be, you know, a light kind of beige colour. But what we found was that if the animal was fed GM feed, that it greatly increased the chance that the stomach would turn into something that was severely inflamed, which means that it was bright red in colour and it was swollen and it was not the sort of stomach you would want to have.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't want to have a pig stomach anyway, and I certainly wouldn't want it laid out on a board. All, you know, different colors. Like, that's really creepy.
Looking at it really hard.
Yeah, I'd like to keep my stomach, whatever color it is, inside my belly where you can't see it.
And you'd probably like it not to be inflamed, too.
No, absolutely not.
So they're the sorts of studies. That's a study that I talk about, and I talk about the problems in the existing safety studies, how poorly studied GM crops are, how easily it would be to get a GM crop that's gone through a regulatory system and still is harmful to health.
Well, it's curious to me. It was being explained to me earlier today that most of these industry studies are only 90 days in duration.
Oh, you're lucky if you get 90 days.
That seems, I mean, I can see on the one hand how that's consistent with their quarterly report profit loss cycle, but I don't understand how you can have any kind of, you know, I mean, gee whiz, some of this stuff only manifests itself over a period of time. It's like 3 months is not going to, it's just not long enough to find out anything, except if your goal is not to find out anything.
Yes, so you're talking about a three-month study. I mean, that's impressively long compared to most studies that are done. I present evidence from 28 GM crops that were reviewed by my government's safety assessor, our food assessor, and there was not a single one of that kind of study there. I mean, the longest study that was done that I looked at was a month, 4 weeks of feeding. And two-thirds of the studies I looked at didn't even have that done to them.
I'd like to see, seven generations.
Well, you'd at least...
Just to pick a number out of the air. That's one that seems to be kind of time-tested and true.
And at least feed it to animals for long enough for adverse effects to appear, for long enough for cancers to appear. And how about feeding it to animals and actually seeing if it harms the reproduction? You see, there are no requirements for doing that.
I've seen studies where animals are offered GM food and, like, normal, evolutionarily produced through the life processes of this planet for billions of years. They don't seem to like GM food. They eat the real stuff.
I've heard stories about that too. I've heard stories from US farmers saying, look, you know, I've got this field of GM maize and I've got this other field of non-GM maize or corn you call it in the state. And you'll get deer walking through the GM crop in order to find the non-GM crop to eat it.
Yeah, so to me that says something more than some of those studies. You know, like you feed a pig GMO corn for 15 minutes, you're like, oh, he's fine.
In fact, I would like to step in here and say that they're having an issue with the cows, with the pigs in the Midwest, you know, on these big hog farms, where there's a problem called failure to thrive, where the piglets, once they're weaned and put on the GMO Roundup Ready feed, they won't eat, and they basically die. They starve to death, and they get so sick that they can't. It's just called failure to thrive.
Now, failure to thrive makes that's a pretty clear picture.
Yeah, and it's about something like 20%. I mean, they're having a really big problem with these piglets just refusing to eat. And
well,
that should be a pretty big hint too, I would think.
Well, one of the things that's pretty interesting to me about each of you, Judy Carmen and Stephanie Senoff, is the intellectual rigor that you're approaching these studies, because you don't just say, oh, well, that doesn't look right to me. You're using very sophisticated biostatistical methodology in order to substantiate significant correlations. So that's really a big deal, and you can't argue with that kind of stuff.
Yes, and indeed. And in fact, what I did was do the sort of feeding study that I think should be done by the industry before GM crops are put on the market. So it's just the better quality study, and once you start doing that sort of thing, what you can find.
Yeah, and of course, there's also, I think you probably know about the Seralini study on the rats, which was...
Is that the one that nobody doesn't like, Seralini?
Yeah, Sarah Leaney was the one who wrote the paper that got retracted.
Oh.
Because the industry just couldn't stand the fact that there was this paper that was showing lots of problems with the rats if they ate this GMO feed for their entire lifespan. So, as you said, 3 months. 3 months is already generous. He went for the entire lifespan. At 3 months, he didn't see any problems. There was nothing statistically significantly different. It was by 4 months that you started to see problems.
Stop. Time. Study over. Sorry. No more information. We're done.
Is that getting too hard?
No, I'm just...
Lots of issues. They had kidney problems and liver problems and big tumors in their mammary tumors, shorter lifespan.
Yeah, that's messed up. That's super messed up. So where, what inspired you each to come to Kauai?
I was asked. How could I refuse? No, I was asked, and it was a great privilege to actually come to Hawaii and to be able to talk to people here about the work that I've done, the work that my colleagues and I have done.
And for me, it's very personal because I have a home in Kauai, and we are planning to retire there. We spend, we'd like to spend more time, but we spend maybe a third of our time there now every year. We're there this entire summer. We love Kauai. It's so beautiful. And we are, you know, very upset about what's happening on the west side and in general in Hawaii, where this is the place where the new GMOs are being developed, which is very disturbing to me. And I would love to see, I mean, my dream would be that Hawaii declares abandoned, and basically says no more GMO and no more glyphosate, no more, you know, to not allow those things into the islands and to become sort of a place where organic food is grown. And is exported, because everyone will know how great that is, that Hawaii only has organic and therefore it's not contaminated. I mean, I can picture this future time many, many years from now. It's not impossible, because this place is really ground zero. You have the worst and the best. You have these wonderful organic farmers around where I live North Shore of Kauai. There are these really people who have been dedicated against the GMOs since the beginning. Have fought so hard and who really appreciate the quality food, you know, growing the food organically, nourishing the soul with the food, and it's wonderful. And then you have the tremendous contrast between that and the chemical industry coming in, the agrochemical industry coming in and pouring poisons over the fields to develop new genes that are going to be resistant to those poisons. I mean, it just really is so. And, of course, in an island community where there's all this, the water, you know, polluting the ocean. I mean, all of it just seems so tragic to me.
Well, you know, you say you can envision a future where Kauai is an organic mecca, but you don't even have to imagine very hard, because it was that way for more than 1,000 years. The Hawaiian people, the Polynesian culture, when they first came here, they didn't bring GMOs. They didn't have herbicides and pesticides, and they didn't use a variety of toxic farming techniques. They worked to enhance and feed the land itself, to increase the vitality of the land itself so that it was productive and healthier. And there's no reason why we can't do that again.
Yes, I really feel it would be great to have that tradition and bring it back and to own it and to say, we are going to do this again. We are going to bring it back. And I think it's not inconceivable that we can do that.
Well, it's not only not inconceivable, it is being done. There's Aupua'a being reactivated all over the island. The Waipa Foundation is almost, I think it is an entire Aupua'a. Kealia is coming back into food production down on the east side. There's a lot of good people doing really good work. And there's a huge core of the Polynesian culture that is still here. Got kind of hammered over the last 200 years or so, but since the Hawaiian Renaissance in the 1970s, it's really been coming back stronger and stronger each generation. And it's really quite an honor and a joy to behold, to be here at this time in history where the Polynesian culture is re-blooming. And there's so much wisdom and values, like tremendous value system, that the Hawaiian culture, an amazingly sophisticated civilization, can bring to and share with the rest of the world. Whereas Western technology is more focused on isolating discrete things, the Hawaiian culture looks more at the relationship between things, and so it's kind of like looking through the other side of the mirror, and it's amazing how many things start to fall into place and make sense when you change your mental worldview.
That's beautifully stated. That's very beautiful. Thank you.
Well, I want you each to know that there's a world film premiere that's going to be released this weekend here on Kauai. I don't know if you'll be here yet on Kauai. But
we will. I'm looking forward to it, and I've got my grandchildren coming, and I want to show it to them. We're going to miss it for the opening. I'm very sorry. We're going to miss the Saturday, Sunday, but we're coming back on Monday, so we will watch it as soon as we can and share it with my grandchildren. It sounds really awesome.
Yeah, it's really beautiful and very inspiring. And I wanted to ask you guys a question about, because you're scientists, and so you work with the technology itself and the science itself, but you know, these things don't exist in a vacuum in our Western, you know, globalized Western culture. The science is in the backseat to the business model, you know, where if something is profitable, then it will be done regardless of whether, you know, the negative consequences can be shoved off the bottom line or outsourced or, you know, so.
And ignore it. I mean, basically, it's not really, they think they're making so much money, but they're ruining so many things that in the long run, they're actually costing much more money when you look at the what's involved in repairing everything that gets damaged.
Right, but they don't have to pay that cost. They just make a mess and then leave, and that's somebody else's problem.
That's right, yes. So it's really so unfair that they're getting such an advantage in our country, you know, that the government is supporting them so strongly. And it's the wrong model, and it's just very, very frustrating for me that we can't get through to the political people who could make a difference if they would just recognize what's happening.
Well, it's curious to me because, you know, people like you who are well-educated and really have put a lot of, you know, decades of research into trying to understand what these new technologies are, it's very complicated for normal people to even, you know, follow what you're saying. And, you know, the industry, since they can make an incredible amount of money, they say that it's fine, but independent researchers like yourself are asking serious questions and pointing to data that does not substantiate the assertions that they're making. But so the science is kind of in question, but what's not in question and what seems to be clearly terrible is the business environment in which it's happening, because that has a massive distortion on what science is able to be published, and it sanctions outcomes that are very negative.
Right. It's very frustrating.
Yes, I agree. And in my view, I think there would be very few indeed commercially produced GM crops if there was no patent on life forms. If that was forbidden, I mean, basically it's my view that it's the patenting system and the fact that if you make a gene and you put it into a crop and therefore you can patent that crop. It's the patenting system that's driving an awful lot of the commercialization of GM crops.
Well, if you couldn't patent it, then you couldn't own it and you couldn't derive profit from it, so then they wouldn't be interested in doing it in the first place.
Yeah, and the costs of making a GM crop are actually really quite high, and you wouldn't get your money back. So it's the patent that's driving it.
Yeah, which is the ownership regime. But, you know, the Western civilization, or not really very civilized, but this Western culture, this way of looking at things, this idea that you can own life, that's pretty crazy. You know, here in Hawaii, you could not own land. Land, aina, that which feeds us, was a community resource that belonged to everybody. You know, that would be like trying to own a piece of the sky. You know, it's just like impossible to conceive. And it should be impossible to conceive creating new life forms that haven't been time tested by the evolutionary processes that brought you and me and everything else into being, and just unleashing them into the world it's so irresponsible.
Right. And, you know, it's true also in the pharmaceutical industry. There's parallels there because they develop these new drugs that are chemicals that are not natural. And those are the things they want to push. They want to market because, again, they can get the patent rights. They can make a lot of money. And yet there are so many natural medications that are so much better for you and so much more effective with many fewer side effects. And those get squashed because you can't make all that money with the patent. So really we're getting a bad deal on the medicine as well as on the food because of this.
Yeah, I think that you have nailed it right on the head. So to me, it's not so much the technology because, you know, new technology is always experimental. There's no debate or question about that, even though the industry is asserting that it's safe, but clearly they have a financial interest in it. What seems to be tremendously problematic and terribly corrupting is the ownership model and the profitability model and the financial environment that is taking place. And that's what's most deeply concerning to me, because if we could get a handle on that, then all the other problems would kind of fall into place, it seems. You know, what you're saying about if they could not patent life, then they would not be doing it.
And it's more than that as well. So Stephanie just talked about pharmaceutical drugs. But if a member of the community wanted to try and work out, somebody like me, a researcher, wanted to see if that new pharmaceutical drug actually had a benefit over the old pharmaceutical drug or over a sugar pill, you could buy the pharmaceutical drug off the shelves of a pharmacy, or I think you call it a drugstore, a chemist, and you could do your own study to see whether it actually had an improvement. And this is what drives a lot of the going forward in pharmaceutical drugs, is when, you know, a pharmaceutical drug gets released into the community because apparently it's safe, then other people can check up on that later on and actually do their own study. But the problem lies, a great problem lies with GM crops, and that it's the patents on these things that largely prevents follow-up studies being done. So, for example...
Because it's proprietary and you're not allowed to study my stuff?
Oh, because if you want to go and buy some GM seeds, you have to sign a legal agreement, a technology user fee agreement, which says that you are not going to do any research on that crop, and you're not going to give it to anyone else to do research on either. So it really slows down the independent safety assessments of these crops.
Oh, it doesn't sound like it slows it down. It seems like it stops it.
It does a pretty good job at slowing it really well, if you know what I mean.
It's amazing that they can get by with stuff like this.
Well, it's some kind of creepy black box that you're not allowed to open. Oh, no, don't just trust us.
Oh, and that gets more interesting than that, because these technology use agreements also have gag clauses, at least in Australia, have gag clauses in them, so that if you're a farmer growing the crop, you then can't tell people if it's doing badly. So you can't talk about the yield your crop has. And, you know, whether it's done going well or not going well.
Yeah, over and over and over again, what seems to me to be the problem in this arena and many others is capitalism, unfettered capitalism that cares much more about capital than it does about people or life or the planet.
That's very well said again.
And then, of course, what you rely upon is how well the regulatory system manages the risks on your behalf. And in my talk, I talk about how the regulatory system should be actually managing the risks of GM crops, and I show how badly it's being done.
Well, so, but that's not a mysterious thing. There's even a name for that. It's called a captured regulatory market.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, I talk about my regulatory system, and then I point out how much worse yours is.
Yeah, well, you know, the USA, they're number one in all kinds of things.
That's true, certainly health care costs.
Yeah, but without the quality of service, so what's up with that?
We spend much more on health care than the next nation, much more, and we have really poor results, you know.
Yeah.
Well,
I was telling Stephanie today that years ago, like in the early 90s, when I was studying my Master of Public Health, even then, the U.S. healthcare system was held up as being the worst in the world in terms of the cost. It costs, you know, per head of population in the U.S. to get so little return on it, to get far worse outcomes in health compared to other countries.
Right. Well, you know, that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is they're making far more money providing far less service than anyone else in the world. So that could be a success story from their view.
As long as we're willing to put up with it, right? Which it seems to me amazing that people just go ahead and put up with it. The amount of money people have to spend on health care is really breaking the backs of some of the people. And, of course, the poorest just can't possibly afford it. It would be ridiculous.
Yeah, no, it's it boggles my mind that Americans in the U.S. don't rise up and say, wow, you know what, we're just, this isn't happening anymore, we're done with that, you guys can pack it up and go somewhere else, because we're going to be nice to each other from now on, and that's we're just going to have to insist on that. Sorry.
You know, because so very many modern Western countries, industrialized countries, have free health care for their population. So in Australia, for example, if you are an Australian citizen, you get free health care. That's it. You can get free health care. If you need an operation, you go to hospital and it costs you nothing.
Well, you know, if you live in a community where everyone is healthy and vital and strong and able to contribute to their maximum, society benefits.
I know. I think that there's this huge hidden cost in our society with all of these sick people that we have. It's really amazing how many, not only, of course, these chronic diseases like diabetes and heart disease, things like Alzheimer's and autism in the children, ADHD, all these, the kids are having so many problems with food allergies and asthma, eczema. I mean, these things are over half the population of the children have one of these, you know, these basic chronic diseases that they're coping with. And that's a huge burden. I mean, of course, it's hard for those kids to have that. It's hard for their parents to have to deal with it all the time. If you've got a peanut allergy, if you get a little peanut, you might die. That's a lot of stress on that family. And we just, you know, we're like, oh, yeah, you know, my kid has allergies. Oh, yeah, my kid gets asthma. It's funny that we just say, oh, yeah, that's normal. I mean, I don't understand. I mean, for myself, you know, at my age, I know when I was a child, we didn't know anybody with these problems. I never met anybody with autism the entire time, you know, for half my life. And I know, you know, autism is all over the place now.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem like it's very clear what the specific causal indicators are. There's lots of correlations, but there's also lots of, you know, combined effects where you have sort of synergistic maladies where multiple things come together and create something worse than any one of them individually could. So the world we live in is so complicated. How do you make a difference between correlation and causality?
Yeah, that's a huge challenge, and that's been really where I focus. You know, I was extremely interested. I became interested in autism about 8 years ago.
And just to let people know, this is Stephanie Senhoff, who's going to be here on the island next week. So please do continue.
Yes, about 8 years ago, I got really nervous about it because I saw that the rates were going up exponentially, and exponential growth is a really scary thing. And so I took upon myself to just take a look and start to look at what are the chemicals that we know are toxic in the environment that the child might be exposed to, and how might the child be exposed to them, and what would be the effects, and looking at how those chemicals affect on biology, and does that fit with what autism is. And I went for 5 years frustrated. I learned a lot about autism, and I learned a lot about what isn't causing autism, because nothing fit. And it wasn't until I heard Don Huber's talk. He's an expert on glyphosate, which is Roundup. That's the active ingredient in Roundup. He's a retired professor of plant physiology and plant pathology. And he has been tirelessly campaigning and giving talks about the toxicity of glyphosate. He talked about specific things that glyphosate causes, and those were the specific things that I couldn't get an explanation for with all the other chemicals I was looking at. And so I put two and two together when I heard that talk, and when I walked away from that talk, I spent the rest of my time for the past 3 years, almost every waking moment, investigating the possibility of a link between glyphosate and autism, and I think I have hit pay dirt. I mean, it is so clear. Every angle I look at, glyphosate is a very complex molecule with a lot of interesting biological effects, and those biological effects match extremely well with what we see as the characteristic symptoms of autism. It is incredibly well matched. And when you add on top of that the 0.99 correlation coefficient between the curves.
What does that mean?
This means basically that when you look over time at the autism rates in the United States, over time, looking back to, say, 1990 or something, and you look back over that same time period at how much glyphosate is being used on corn and soy crops, which you can get that from the U.S. government, you plot those two curves, they coincide.
So that's certainly intriguing. But how do you discern if that is merely coincidence, you know, like
why you do the study of the metabolism. You look at what glyphosate does to biological systems. For example, glyphosate chelates manganese and makes it unavailable. The studies on cows showed, and they looked at a lot of minerals, manganese was way below the minimum expected number for the range of manganese in the blood. Manganese is really, really important for lots of things. Autistic kids have been shown to have low manganese in the blood, low manganese in their urine, and low manganese in their baby teeth. So this is all pointing to manganese deficiency. And on top of that, they have a bunch of symptoms that could be explained by manganese deficiency. So they have, for example, oxidative damage in the brain, which is because manganese is needed to fix that problem. Glutamate toxicity, because manganese is needed to detox glutamate. Bone problems, because manganese is needed to make your bones healthy. I mean, all of these things match very, very well.
I see. So it's not just a circumstance of glyphosate use went up and autism went up, but you're actually correlating some of the specific biological consequences that have been shown to be characteristic of the
right.
components in glyphosate. I guess I understand what you're saying.
I mean, you can read my papers. There are so many.
I might not be able to read your papers.
Well, so, but we go into a lot of specifics about the links, and that's where I started, actually. I wasn't aware of that curve when I wrote the first article with Anthony Sampson, where we suggested that glyphosate could be causing autism, and we were suggesting it based on this physiological evidence that I had gotten from Don Huber's talk, and then I went and read papers to make sure that he was right, and we explained it in this paper about disrupting the gut microbes, which autistic kids have a lot of issues with their gut. And glyphosate is a patented antimicrobial agent, and so it messes up the gut microbes and causes the pathogens, the bad guys, to overgrow, and that gets you the inflamed gut, which, of course, Judy saw that with her GMO crops. Those crops were probably exposed to glyphosate. And so, I mean, that's just one example, but we saw significant links between glyphosate and autism.
Very complementary, so I look at the safety of GM crops. But please understand that the most commonly planted GM crop is one that is made resistant to Roundup or glyphosate, so that it's designed so that when you spray the crop lives while the weeds around it die. And so therefore, if the most commonly grown GM crop is resistant to Roundup, then you would expect the amount of Roundup used on crops would go up, and therefore the exposure of Roundup would actually increase over time.
Right, and then the company that owns the GM corn also owns the Roundup, and it's actually producing an increase in sales of their product line. So, you know, again, it's the business model.
It is, and it's written into those technology user agreements, because there's an awful lot of glyphosate out there, different formulations of glyphosate. So if you want to grow Roundup-ready soy, for example, you sign that technology user fee that you will actually use the Roundup brand, the Monsanto brand of Roundup.
Oh, so market protecting.
Yes, so they are joining together the use of their chemical with the use of their seeds. They're joined together at the hip.
Yeah, it's a synergy. It's brilliant. It's opening up a new profit center. It's couldn't be more wonderful.
Yes, particularly since glyphosate was about to go off of patent protection. It was a new means of one of the things that people talk about as the possibility, shall we say, that it was a new means of keeping sales of glyphosate up when other people could have been using other cheaper products.
Corporations have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize their profit for the shareholders. So if they weren't doing that, they wouldn't be doing their job, and they'd get fired, and they would hire a new CEO who would do what they needed to do to get the job done.
That's right.
Well, tell us a little bit about these three upcoming events. I want to make sure people know about Tuesday, the 28th, at the Waimea Canyon Middle School at 6:30. Wednesday, the 29th, at 7 p.m., the Church of the Pacific up on the North Shore. And then Thursday, the 30th, at KCC Performing Arts Center at 7 p.m. That's going to be a pretty big event, yeah?
Yes, I hope so. I mean, I hope you all come on down and listen to us. We'll be doing a tag team talk, as we said. Judy will talk about the GM crops. And then I will follow with a talk about glyphosate and how it's causing so much harm to humans as well as to the animals and et cetera. And so,
I believe that we may be broadcasting that live.
Yes.
Find out from, is that a confirmation on that?
Yes, the one in the Art Center, the third one.
Okay, yeah, so for folks listening right now, you should know that Thursday evening next week at 7 p.m., KKCR will be going live to the KCC Performing Arts Center and broadcasting these presentations by Judy Carman, Stephanie Senhoff, and I believe also Lauren Pang will be joining you, yeah?
Yes. And Lauren Pang will also be there, Lauren Pang, talking at the third one, at that one that's going to be recorded. There'll be the three of us talking.
All right, and for folks who'd like to know, Lauren Pang is the Director of Health for Maui County, a consultant for the World Health Organization on infectious diseases, as well as drug efficacy for SmithKline Glaxo. So those are the big boys.
And I'm also on the technical expert committee of the United Nations on safety assessments and risk assessments of GMOs. They call them LMOs, living modified organisms.
Yeah, I didn't mean to give you short shrift by not putting your whole CV on there. I apologize to the listener. Your qualifications and the list of things that you've done and your academic credentials are so long. I thought it might take up the entire show just to read them.
She's impressive, huh?
Yeah, no, it's really quite amazing.
Thanks, you're very sweet.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us this afternoon and letting listeners know that these three events are coming up. It's really nice when you do that in different parts of the island. That way, people who live in different parts of the island don't have to go all the way up to the North Shore or all the way out to the West Side. You know, you're bringing the event to them, which I think is a really, it's a really inspiring way to communicate with the public. So that more of us can learn what's going on in our world.
Thank you. Thank you. And thanks for everyone who will turn up. I hope you turn up. And thank you very much for having us on your program.
Oh, my pleasure. Do you guys want to give some contact info, like websites or something, so that people can find out more?
Yes, there's one. I don't actually run this website. It's a fan site, but all of the those gruesome pictures you talked about of the inflammation in the stomachs is on the website, and when the industry and people associated with them tries to make a comment, adverse comment about the work that we've done, all the rebuttals are on the site as well. And that's simply called GMO Judy Carman. So that's GMO Judy, spelled like Judy with a Y, and Carman, C-A-R-M-A-N, so it's one man in a car, not two, .org. And you'll see all that information up there.
So that's judycarman.org.
That's it. And I have a web page, but it's kind of long, but let me tell it to you. It's people, P-E-O-P-L-E,
okay.
Dot CSAIL, that's my lab, Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, C-S-A-I-L.
C-S-A-I-L, okay.
Dot MIT dot EDU.
Dot MIL.
No MIL. Dot EDU, then slash Seneff, my last name, S-E-N-E-F-F.
All right, so
I'll get you to my webpage. There's a bunch of stuff there. You can also just Google, even you could probably just Google Seneff because it's kind of an unusual name if you can remember it.
S-E-N-E-F-F?
Two Fs, yes, at the end. And that will give you lots of various interviews and stuff, you know.
So one N and two Fs.
Radio interviews and various articles. Some articles, you know, criticizing my work by the probably... linked to the GMO folks, but...
Well, it doesn't sound to me like your work can't stand legitimate scrutiny. That's the whole premise of science when it's not grotesquely distorted by market forces. So, you know, I wish you the best of luck, and I hope that lots of people come and scrutinize your work. It can only make it better.
Right. No, I appreciate it when people can find problems with it, but it's not, you know, sometimes there's more of a... attempt to discredit without the adequate knowledge to do it right. So,
well, I want to thank each of you for joining us this afternoon and look forward to your presentations across the island coming to a neighborhood near you.
Thank you for having us. Thank you. It was great.
All right. Aloha.
Mahalo and aloha.
Ahui ho and malama pono.
Thanks, guys.
All right. So those are two very impressively educated women who understand a whole heck of a lot more than I do about organic chemistry, about human metabolism, about biostatistical analysis of data. And it's impressive to me when people as smart as that can break it down to explain it to people as ignorant as you or I. You know, specialized knowledge is sometimes so difficult to share, and it's always really wonderful when people can actually articulate, they can actually explain what all that gobbledygook means, because, you know, where would we be without them? Coming up next, we're going to do a little feature on Ina, the film coming up this weekend at the KCC Performing Arts Center. And if you haven't seen it yet, I want to let you know about the website Ina Feeds Us. That's AINAFEEDS, INAFeeds.us. That's INAFeeds.us. And it's a very interesting and beautiful film, kind of a documentary that was just produced and is going to be having its world premiere coming this Saturday. The tickets are all sold out for that, but we do have tickets to give away. So I'm going to play the preview for you here, and we'll come back and do the top of the hour stuff. But so don't call yet. But after we get back to the top of the show, anybody who knows what Ina means.
They're not farming. They're doing research.
This is the hotspot on the planet for pesticide exposures.
Every banned pesticide was once thought to be safe.
These are multi-billion dollar corporations. They can afford to protect the people who live next to them.
We have signed our own papalamake, our death warrant.
Westernization brought the idea that the land's a commodity. The land is a resource.
Many of us have the sense that we need to do our share to malama ke iamoku o kawaii, to take care of this beautiful little gem in the ocean called kawaii.
We can teach a whole new generation about holistic thinking, critical thinking, and the truth.
The truth will prevail.
We're all related to this, and we have to see it. That's all I ask.
Yeah, so, you know, through the magic of radio, it's not always easy to see the images, but I think that it's fairly evocative. And if you're intrigued by that and you'd like to see the film, the number here is 826-7771. We've got the first couple callers. You can explain what the word Ina means. It's a word in Hawaiian. It basically translates to land. But if you know the more subtle, deeper explanation, then you and a friend can get some free tickets to see the film on Saturday. So I'm going to go thank the underwriters who make this show and other shows just like this possible, and thank them so much. And thank you for listening this afternoon. It's pretty fantastic. Really appreciate it. You are the community in community radio.
KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K224CQ Anahola, K284AL Haleiwa.
And we also want to thank these fantastic underwriters, Hawaii Life, Tahiti Nui, and Compassionate Care.
Neil Norman and the Hawaii Life Brokerage Ohana proudly supports GMO-free Kauai, agricultural biodiversity, and sustainable farming practices, such as community gardens, food forests, seed saving, and beekeeping. Malama aina.
Announcing the return of the Tahiti Nui's Hanalei Luau, featuring 50 years of songs and dances as a tribute to their mama, Auntie Louise. Tahiti Nui, providing live Hawaiian music on Kauai since 1963. This family-style luau is every Wednesday, 5 to 7:30. More information at 826-6277 or online at thenui.com.
Kevin Bako, MD of Hawaii Compassionate Care, offers medical marijuana certification exams at his office in Kapa'a. Information and appointments available at 808-854-6335 or online at hawaiicompassionatecare.com.
Thank you so much. I'm on the phone here talking to Victoria Dietrich. She's the first person to call in with the translation of Aina, that which feeds us. And I'm going to finish up with her, and then we'll go to an interview with Josh Thome. He's the director of the film. He's going to be on island tomorrow. For the film tomorrow night. Saturday. But I had a chance to speak with him before he got onto his airplane to come out here. And this is what we talked about yesterday. This is the first time I've ever actually done an interview on the phone and then edited it down to take out the ums and the ers and the uhs. So please enjoy this. This is Josh Thome, the director of the film Aina, which is going to be having its world premiere on Saturday at KCC. Aloha, Josh.
Aloha.
I'm speaking with Josh Thome. He's the director of the new film, Aina, which is going to have its world premiere here on Kauai this weekend. I thought this would be a great opportunity to talk with you a little bit, and maybe you could tell us about your background and how you came to find out about these issues on Kauai and what inspired you to make this film.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. Great to be here. My background is interesting. It kind of combines both of these things in terms of the environment and agriculture and filmmaking. And in terms of the environment, I grew up in the beautiful mountains of British Columbia, just a really beautiful place in the world, like Kauai, and obviously very different, but similar in its beauty. And my parents they grew a lot of our food in kind of a system that today might be thought of as permaculture. So I just had this understanding of, or this close connection to food production, and also this understanding of how these systems work together, and also how everything was so tightly connected. But I also grew up with this great appreciation for the beauty of nature, and you know, as I grew up and had the opportunity to travel a lot, I learned about what was happening to the environment, both where I live and around the world. And so that got me engaged in these issues and started me down the path of working on seeing what I could do to help change things. And along the way, that led to filmmaking. The first film, I was involved with a project where we were bringing together all of these really inspiring young leaders from around the world. We're doing this week-long event that was really powerful, where people would, you know, these leaders, by the very nature of being a leader, they're kind of a bit alone out there, out front, if you will. And so to bring everyone together and create a space where they can let down their guard and just really be human for a minute and be among peers who are going through similar things, we did a lot of these kinds of events, and they just were really successful, and they really helped these people take things to another level. And so eventually we did this global one where we brought all these amazing young leaders from all over the world. And I just had the thought, if we're going to bring all these people together, we need to interview them and get this collective message of young people around the world talking about the environment. So I interviewed everybody and drove my vehicle out to Cincinnati for a couple months, the event happened in California, but I had a edit studio donated in Cincinnati and parked out front there for a couple months and edited my first video. And then one thing led to another, and MTV ended up picking it up to broadcast as their Worldwide Earth Day special. And so that really got me into this idea of how powerful broadcast media can be and how many people can reach. And then what that video did for our organization was called YES, Youth for Environmental Sanity. And they're still going strong, still doing these events all over the world, which is pretty amazing. It's like a decade now of doing these kinds of events.
How did you first find out about Kauai and struggles that we're having here with large-scale, monocrop, pesticide-intensive industrial agriculture?
Well, my first connection to Kauai was when I was 10 years old and my family took a vacation. So I had some sense of how special this place was. And I, you know, as over the last couple of years, as things really heated up there, it came more and more on my radar, and it just kind of tapped into this deep place from my childhood where I remember the beauty of this place. And, you know, I've been aware of these issues globally for a long time and involved in working on these things. And it just made me, I just had this feeling of, come on, can we please just save, not destroy one really nice place in the world. And there's just something so special about Kauai. That's one thing I don't need to explain to anybody on the radio here. Everyone knows that. So that was the first inkling. And then after my son was born, we had some maternity leave time, and we went to Kauai. And then while we were there, I started to tune in more and more to what was actually happening. But also this other story started to emerge. And that's really what started to perk my interest. It's such an interesting dynamic happening on Kauai. There's two models of agriculture that are kind of on opposite extremes. You've got global industrial agriculture has such a huge presence, but then you have the traditional Hawaiian system, and that's the other part of the story. And that's really, that kind of represents the two paths that we can go with agriculture in the world. You know, not obviously that the world's going to adopt specifically a Hawaiian system of ahupua'as, but the tenets of it and the ideas around it and even the science of it, as well as some of the art of it, there's so much in that that represents a different way of relating to the earth that feeds us. And Kavika Winter, who's just an amazing person to interview, who knows the ahupua'a system so well, has a PhD ethnobotanist. He's just this incredible wealth of knowledge. And he said it super well in the film. He was talking about there's this idea that when humans interact with nature, nature is depleted for humans' benefit. But the Hawaiians had a different idea about how to go about it. And their presence on the islands helped raise the aquifer, helped the soil build. It made the forests and the oceans more productive. So that idea of working with nature instead of trying to dominate it, different ideas about how we relate to the earth through agriculture, and it's a bit of a crossroads that we're at globally.
Yeah, it seems like it's really kind of a contrast between cooperating versus trying to control nature.
And it's really an interesting dynamic happening with Kauai. It's like a microcosm. In a similar way that the ahupua'a being a resource management system that happens within the context of a watershed, you can wrap your head around it. You know, there's the top of the mountain, and here's the water system, and here's the relationship with that flow of water, where it enters into the ocean, and then all the way out to the reef, and everything about how that's being managed and how that relationship is happening. Because it happens in such a small space, it's so much easier to even just get the idea of sustainability. But this model takes it to a whole other level. This is actually managing resources for abundance. It's a whole other thing.
I think the Hawaiian culture or tradition or value system really has to do with maintaining and increasing the life of the land itself.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I mean, this is a system that developed over 7,000 years of moving through the Pacific and figuring out how to live on little islands. So by the time we got to Hawaii, we had a pretty good idea of how to do this. And it's one of the greatest achievements of humanity, I think. But similar to how this, you can wrap your head around the system of the Nahupua, Kauai as an island almost allows the opportunity to wrap your head around the global context of agriculture and some of the challenges we face.
Sure, because you actually have the intersection of a command and control versus a cooperation model right here in your face.
It's a stark contrast that's happening there. The show itself, Aina, the film, it's not trying to get into the whole debate of are GMOs good or bad or whatever, or do we use less or more pesticides. It's more how can we solve some of the bigger problems and what role does agriculture play? They're super complex things and there's no easy answer to any of it. So it's more exploring these issues, looking at some of the problems and how agriculture can play a role in the solution. And that's really the inspiring part about it, is that agriculture is one of the biggest problems we face as it is today in terms of the pollution that it creates, the contribution to global warming, all of the inputs and problems with it, but it's also one of the greatest solutions that we as individuals can participate in because we vote 3 times a day.
Tell us a little bit about the film and what we can expect this weekend when the film has its world premiere at the Kauai Community College campus.
Yeah, this weekend's going to be something special. People can expect to have their mind blown. It's really an absolutely beautiful film. It's some of the best cinematography in the world and some of the best music. And the music composer who did the score is named Jacob Yaffe. And the other project he's been working on during this time are the Star Wars trailers. So it's really this absolutely amazing piece of work. We're really excited about it just on a production and creative level. But then, of course, it's Kauai that's at the heart of it. And so it's just highlighting, putting the beauty of Kauai on full display and really letting the aloha shine through.
Talk about a photogenic movie star. If Kauai isn't that, I don't know what is. Just want to break into this interview just for a quick moment. I hope that you are enjoying it. But I wanted to let people know that the film Aina sold out for Saturday night, but we have some tickets here for folks if you would like to go to the show on Sunday. Doors will open at 3 and the film will start at 4. It's a matinee on Sunday. And if you can tell me what the word Aina means, it means land is the simple translation, but if you can explain the deeper level of how the Hawaiians view land, you can get some tickets. You and a friend can go see Aina, the film and the world premiere on Sunday at KCC. So the number here, the telephone lines are 826-7771. And I'm going to go right back into this interview so you can hear more from the film director, Josh Thome.
Yeah, this is pretty amazing setup. Of course, forward to being back and being in the room for this.
Well, thank you so much for the excellent work that you've done. I've seen the trailers, and it looks absolutely sumptuous. So I think it should be a visual treat. And it seems to have a really strong emotional impact. So I hope that there will be very, very many good things that come from this work.
I believe there will. I certainly hope so. It is very strong, definitely, because that's the power of Kauai. You come to Kauai, you know, people come to Kauai for their honeymoon or because they had a baby or because they're getting married. It's that kind of place. It's everyone, again, your listeners know, but it's really, it has something very special to it. And, you know, we just wanted to do our best to try and reflect that and showed it to some people around here in Vancouver. And it certainly seems to have that effect.
One of my philosophies or approaches to making media is just to do it live and go. And
yeah,
you do the best you can, and usually it's pretty good.
You're right.
It's usually pretty good. And you know, you have like something approaching a 1-to-1 time ratio.
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
which I have great confidence that's not how you put this film together.
No, definitely not.
How many hours? The film's what, 23 minutes long?
Yeah, so 23 minutes.
So how many hours did it take to make 23 minutes?
Yeah, it was interesting. The whole process was quite something, because originally we were trying to get it out super fast, and then things changed, and so we ended up having it's basically been a year. We ended up having a lot of time with it, and just having the ability to work on it, then step away and come back to it, really helps take it to new levels every time.
Sure, because you get some perspective on things.
Yeah, it had time to ripen. And at this point, I feel like we've done the absolute best we possibly can with the materials that we have. We just really went for it. And, I mean, Kauai inspired all of us so much that we all just wanted to give it our all. So this has kind of been our passion project for the last year. You know, at times it's taken center stage, but the rest of the time it's the thing that we're excited to come back to and work on for a little while.
What are some of your distribution options that you're looking at in terms of how this piece can be shown, where people can see it? I mean, obviously it's a film right now and you can have screenings of it. And I understand there's simultaneous global thunderclap Facebook distribution. But where else do you hope to be able to get this film?
Yeah, I think the two main venues that this film will play for the world are online and in film festivals and at special events, like what we're doing on Kauai. I think those will be kind of the main venues for it.
It seems like if you've got a 23-minute piece, that's perfect for half-hour programming slots and commercial television.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a whole other beast. I think that I'm honestly more excited about digital distribution to get it onto a television screen where people can watch it anywhere and anytime than broadcast channels with commercials and the whole deal. It's interesting too for broadcasters. They're mostly interested for one-off pieces. They're mostly interested in hour-long programming. It's usually they're looking for a 45-minute piece. So it's a different, it's just a whole different ballgame. My last project was a TV series, and it was on TV. There were 8 half-hour episodes. They were all 23 minutes. And they broadcast all around the world on National Geographic and Travel Channel. And, you know, I've been through that experience of the television world. And that project started early on when they were more of afraid online. They didn't want it to be online.
Yeah, it's taken a while for that whole maturation of the new media platforms.
Yeah. But this is really meant to be seen by as many people as possible. I mean, this is a tool to raise awareness and inform people, inspire people, and engage people. So that's always been the nature of my work, has been the outreach that involves the education, the inspiration, and then the follow-up that involves the engagement. Those two parts of the formula have taken many different forms over time, and once it got into media, it was broadcast, media or videos, and then internet follow-up. But now it's all merged. It's all coming together in one place, and it's a seamless experience that people can connect with something, they can get involved. It's just a really amazing time for this kind of thing, and the world, it's just so phenomenal how networked the world has become in such a short period of time. And it's one of the things that offers a bit of hope, too. We have the ability to organize and activate and make things happen in a way that we could only have dreamed of before. So, fantastic.
As far as engagement, inspiring direct action from a non-passive audience, where can you direct people to plug in if they're inspired to take action or support the reinvigoration of traditional, generationally sustainable Hawaiian cultural traditions and values?
It's interesting with this film, been keeping an eye on what's happening on the ground and what this might connect to in terms of opportunities for people to participate in campaigns. And things are changing so fast that we just realized we just need to make a really good film.
And then see where it goes.
And then, and then just allow people to be able to connect with us on Facebook and through email and whatnot, and be a part of this over time. and engage over time. And, you know, there's so many great people. You know, my focus is making films, but there's so much great work happening on all the other aspects of it, from the politics to everything else. So letting those people do their thing, and everything happens at its own time. So, you know, and of course these issues and change and life in general, it's an ongoing, we're in for the long haul, it's an ongoing vigil. You can't, there's no end to it. It's just part of a culture, part of a lifestyle. So, you know, we're looking at it like that. We want people to be in for the long haul, and, you know, true to the nature of what we're talking about in the content, this is a multi-generational process. And so we need to just take a long view and a steady pace with it and connect over time. And I think, you know, so as things come up and as opportunities for people to engage, then we'll let them know, whoever's connected through our network. And of course, there's many other networks as well. So I think the more that we can all work together, in kind of rallying people at different times for different opportunities to make something happen, that's how we can do it.
Where would you direct people to, like a central location for people to plug in?
Yeah, so our website for the project is inafeeds.us. So A-I-N-A-F-E-D-E-E-D-S, inafeeds.us.us. So inafeeds.us.
Well, that's awesome, Josh Thome. Thanks for speaking with us today. Wish you the best of luck in this endeavor, and look forward to meeting you this weekend at KCC with the world premiere of your new film, Aina.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Jonathan. Aloha.
Aloha and ahui ho.
It's going to be intense. I like this film is really something.
So that was an interview I made yesterday with Josh Thome before he had to wrap up all his gear from British Columbia, Vancouver, where he lives, and make his way to the airport. I think he's in the air now as we're speaking, but through the magic of radio and audio editing, able to bring that interview to you today. Kind of an interesting experience for me because I have not done a lot of audio editing before, but happy to do that. I hope you enjoyed that. We've got a caller on the line right now, I think. Caller, are you there with us? All right, here we go. On the line right now, we have Brother Tim Kalai.
Hey, thank you, Jonathan. And as always, got to put out, you know, the big appreciations, gratitude, mahalo, you know, for what you do, you know, for our particular, you know, radio station. And that is bringing in, you know, some wonderful topics, some great people, you know, at a very crucial time. You know, I think that we are at the pinnacle right now. And I think, you know, there's a whole lot that's going on, and that we really have to look within ourselves, not only as people of this Aina, you know, but of the bigger picture, you know, that is on a global, you know, perspective.
Sure, this island Earth.
It is. What are we doing, and where are we on our consciousness, you know, on our paths living in this space and time, you know, and we're at that tipping point, people. You know, it's when are we going to stand up for the inherent sacredness and our rights to do what we know is totally right, and to quote unquote teach the corporate element, you know, that not everything is for sale, not everything can be bought or sold at a whimsy, because it brings profiteering, you know, to the forefront. And this is basically, you know, what this gentleman, Josh, I think, is going to try to convey to us, you know, through the art medium of film, video, you know. And I think I'm excited because, yes, you know, I'm looking forward, you know, to seeing this presentation, to participating in it, to broaden, you know, my perspective, my depth of knowledge, you know, which is always an ongoing thing, and it should be for all of us, you know, with what is happening and what we do and how we personally go about affecting, you know, our Mother Earth, you know, and the sanctity and the sacredness of that, you know. And I know that you are asking, you know, your callers to give in, and even at the end of kind of Josh's interview there, he kind of gave away, you know, the crux of what Aina kind of says. You
well,
know,
I wasn't trying to keep it a secret.
Yeah, I know, of course not, my brother. You know, and bless you for doing that. You know, everybody knows when they refer to I or may I, you know, that refers to food. You know, the food, and, you know, and the term of na, you know, meaning in the plural or the sense of plural, you know, much. So I na, that which gives us much or that which gives us bounty. You know, what is that? You know, that is our mother, the most sacred and most precious thing from hence which we come through the nourishment, you know, of the earth. And as the culture, you know, the Kanaka Maoli believe that it was the, you know, the oha, you know, that brings that into the essence. And then hence, you know, the many that come from it, us are children. We are the na, you know, the food, you know, that comes from that oha na. You know, keep going with that thought process. It can get very deep as you keep peeling back more and more and the more you look into it, you know. So this is something that we have to really start taking a stance on, because why is it at one of the most sacred places on earth here in paradise? You know, is it really paradise, or what are these corporate entities doing trying to poison us, poison our water to death?
Well, you know, I don't, and this is just my personal opinion, so
yes, of course,
I don't think that they're trying to poison people to death. I just think that they've recognized they can make money doing that. So they're really focused on the making money thing. The poisoning people to death thing, that's just kind of like collateral damage. You know, that doesn't really show up on the quarterly reports.
No, it doesn't.
So, you know, I don't think that they're evil, and I don't think that they're certainly not stupid.
But then why do they refuse to do the true science behind it? Why do they negate that completely and act like it doesn't exist?
Well,
when there is, by their own peers, showing, you know, that this stuff is detrimental to you.
Well, I can't.
We're not just singling out one, you know, pesticide. And man, they don't even talk about the combinations of what these cocktails do.
Well, you know, it's legitimately complicated to understand. So, you know,
yes,
Dr.
Yes.
Judy Carmen.
Well, all three of them, the Australian gal.
Okay.
You know, as she was putting this up and stating to us, you know, that there are things that we really have to take into consideration, you know, and there does come a point in time when we have to stand up and take a stance on this and say, once again, no more. You know, we don't have a massive amount of Aina, no pun intended,
yeah, just
Nua, that we can sit there and just roam across, like on the continent of Australia or on the continent of North America, South America, or any place. You know, we're on an island here, and it is to the micro scale that everybody else has. And yet here we are considered, quote-unquote, if we use the term, ground zero for one of the most toxic places in the world to be. And it's like, how can that be when we make references and the rest of the world makes reference to this place as paradise?
Well, you know, I can't remember if it's Roy Rogers or Will Rogers, because I always get those two guys confused. But one of them said, it's awfully difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon him not understanding it.
You know, and it's amazing you say that, because no more than we were out today also trying to do some good works, and we were in Kapa'a Town, you know, right across from the new Kauai store, you know, that used to be the old business support center down there in Kapa'a Town.
Oh, yeah, I saw that closed.
No, oh, I mean, business support did, yes,
right.
And they actually just moved their location.
Oh, okay, good.
They did not close their business.
Oh, where are they located now?
They are now located right across from the Shell gas station, the first Shell gas station in Big Save, you know.
Oh, okay, right, so they moved pretty close.
Yeah, pretty close.
Okay,
right,
that's
right,
good to know.
Out,
I appreciate
right there.
That.
Yeah, it's a great place. Still
yeah.
A great store, still doing great business.
Oh, that's great, because I didn't know where to make copies, so thank you for that.
Okay, well, you're more than welcome.
So yes, thank you for that public service. I've got another caller.
Let me
calling.
Write this up real
well,
quick.
Well, actually, I'm hoping that you can just, I can put you on pause. We can take the next caller, because I want to come back to you with another,
okay.
another question. So,
okay, great.
Let me
great.
Try to do that. All right.
Do that, if you can, Jonathan.
Is that second caller here? Oh, I'm sorry, caller. Please call back. Okay, so...
Okay, I'm still here, though.
Oh, there...
I wanted to wrap up my thought that I was continuing with, you know,
okay.
in the course of this whole thing.
Sure.
No more than I'm at this store visiting it and totally checking it out. Wonderful things that they're doing there. It's all Kauai-made products, everything of this nature. But I'm looking outside the door, you know, at the highway, and directly across the street is where there is a little canal, you know, that
sure.
feeds out to the Kauai Ocean there.
Right.
And no more than the state, there's a white state truck that pulls up. They park across the street, and I'm just kind of watching things. I'm like, oh, okay, I wasn't paying attention at that time.
And I just want to say, caller who's standing by, please be patient, and
okay.
I'll get
yeah,
to you
I'll
right
do
next.
Quickly.
Sure.
But I look out the door a few minutes later, and here the guy is with the solo backpack, gunning away, cranking his arm thing, spraying. Once again, no respirator, no gloves, no nothing. Just spraying away the guinea grass and everything.
Was he
right
naked?
No, he was not. He had clothing on, Levi's,
okay.
boots.
Okay,
and
so he wasn't no nothing. He wasn't naked.
No.
Okay.
But he's out there spraying away the guinea grass, and he's just going, you know, nailing it down. So I walk out with my camera, of course, to document this. I didn't know where the guy came from. I just thought he was a gardener. But I'm watching this, and then no more. I'm watching him go back with his backpack, and lo and behold, because it was like maybe 60 feet away is where they had to park off the side of the road, and it was the state vehicle, and the guy gets into the vehicle, and I'm looking at this just kind of going, and so they turn around, and of course they come across the street to where I'm taking photographs, and one of the gentlemen on the passenger side says, excuse me, what exactly are you doing? I'm saying, man, I'm just taking some photographs, and I started to tell into him because I was a little bit upset, and I says, you guys know what you're actually doing.
Did you show him love?
I tried to, yes.
Because that's how you actually communicate with people.
I did.
You love him.
I tried to tell him in a very loving fashion that unfortunately his practices were quite detrimental, not only to himself because he was not wearing the proper or appropriate gear, but also to the rest of us, not just us, but to the fish, to the ocean, the whole scenario. I said, did you see how close you were to the canal when you're spraying the stuff? And then I asked him, excuse me, first and foremost, what are you spraying? Oh, nothing. It's only Roundup. And I'm like, oh, okay, it's only Roundup. Gee, thanks. You know, that makes me feel good. And I said, gentlemen, have you guys educated yourselves at all about this, you know, and what Roundup does and the kind of chemicals and things that are in this and how you're not supposed to use it close to a waterway? Well, you know, long story short, the guy says, you know what, I'm only doing what my superiors from my job told me to do.
You know what? That makes a lot of sense.
It does. And I said, well, you know what? You guys need to educate your boss then, because this is not okay. And what you guys are doing and how you're doing it is not okay. And I didn't get upset with them. I was just kind of saying, gentlemen, I'm really sorry that I had to take photographs, but I am currently using this as a documentary because of some things that we're doing. And here too, really, my brothers, I totally feel for you to have to do your job, and you folks are doing it okay. But it's time that you need to stand up and educate yourselves, people. We all need this kind of education. It just cannot go on as status quo anymore. We're killing ourselves slowly. We really are, you know. And this is not a good thing for us. Not if we wish to be around or to even have our grandchildren's grandchildren be around in seven generations.
All right, well, hold on to that thought.
I'll hold on.
Yeah, and we're going to go to the next caller. And then I have a completely different topic I want to ask you about. So.
All right, right on.
And thank you, other caller, for standing by.
Yes, thank you, other caller.
Aloha, other caller. You are on the air. Thank you so much for being so patient.
No worries. No worries. Aloha. Yeah, I just am chiming in on this whole trip that these guys that spray. They don't think they're doing any problem or anything wrong, but I was driving on the old highway, Ko'olau Road, the other day, and as I was driving past Zuckerville, everybody knows where that is.
I don't know where that is.
Oh, Zuckerville? It's
Zuckerville,
yeah. It's, you know, those 600 or whatever, 700 acres that Mark Zuckerberg bought.
You know, if I'm understanding correctly where you're talking about, there's one of the most beautifully, impeccably built dry stone walls there. It must be like a
He does this to cut costs, and they can't hand weed everything. But this guy is the bazillionaire, right? Richest guy, one of the, you know, youngest billionaire ever.
I think he only has like $34 billion. He doesn't have an infinite amount of money, just $34
billion. Yeah, I understand that $34 billion, but I think $34 billion connotes enough money that he can have some people hand weed those areas. And, you know, if you hand weed them and you really get the roots out, they stay barren for quite some time. I do it on my own driveway, you know, and it's just you can't say that, oh, we're doing this to cut costs, because the guy's got enough billions to pay some people a good wage to keep it all nice and have his line of no grass on
yeah.
the wall and no grass on the telephone pole.
Some people and, just like it dead. That's what I observe. It's not my trip, but I see some people, wow, they really like it dead.
I guess that's it, but it just really kind of like got under my skin, literally. You know, as I'm driving past, as this stuff is blowing, and it's kind of annoying. And maybe we could put out a giant Kauai Facebook, hey, Mr. Zuckerberg, how about, you know, employ a few Filipinos that will hand weed your, you know, or whoever. It doesn't have to be Filipinos. I don't mean to be racist like that, but, you know, pay some people a wage. I know he's paying a bunch of people salaries and all that stuff, and there's some guys that got really good jobs working for Zuckerberg over there in Zuckerville. But, you know, he could pay a few more people, and he's got the dough to do it. And just stop spraying, please. Please, well, Mr. Zuckerberg, stop spraying.
I think the idea of, you know, starting a Facebook page is a really great idea. I hear that social media stuff is, you know, really potent. Thank you for calling in, caller. Appreciate it.
Aloha.
Aloha. So, Tim, you still with us?
I'm still with you, my brother.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you about your ahupua'a. I wanted to ask you about your moku, and I wanted to ask you, a little bird told me that you've been going down to the state Historical Preservation Division and volunteering your time to help them put together their library of sacred and historic sites. That's awesome.
Well, thank you, you know, for acknowledging that. And whichever little bird you got that from, it's a very observant bird. You know, we have certainly been doing that. That is Hope and myself, you know, to help our newly our new arrival to this island, that is in the form, you know, Mary Jane Naone as our state archaeologist.
Yeah, she's the Kauai, and she's the Kauai lead archaeologist. So
she is.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
so. And what does it entail? What have you been doing?
Well, basically, she, I guess, inherited, like, you know, I don't know, 20 some odd years of files and paperwork, all in the form of boxes.
Yeah, just dumped into boxes,
just
all
dumped
random.
Into boxes at random,
yeah.
And given to her.
Just stuffed.
And yeah, when she was kind of at one time in an open discussion with Hope and myself, stating on how she had this undaunting task now of trying to somehow make sense and go through. And when Hope and I were starting to listen, you know, just to, you know, her inherently, she wasn't asking for help.
No, she was just telling you, like, wow, look at this amazing headache I have.
Yes, and on top of already all of the work which she has to do along with that, which is continually doing the day-by-day elements of going out to job sites, or, you know, when people are developing, or and they uncover something, you know, that she still has to go out there and make sure that there is some documentation, if there hasn't been already, that then she has to go through protocol.
Yeah, well, she's
such things,
she's
yeah.
lucky to even have an office to work out of. But explain to people the documents that you've been helping sort out, helping file.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm not, you know, not totally akamai with, you know, what she has there. But a lot of them are just basically, you know, like site plans and records, you know, certain site records of notable, you know, once again, significant and cultural importance. And all of the CIAs that have been done on the island of Kauai.
What does that stand for?
A cultural impact assessment.
Oh, okay.
You know, a CIA. Yeah, this one isn't the one that brings in.
They're not from Langley.
No, they're not. You know, but and we've basically just Hope and myself told Mary that if it was okay, you know, that we would more than gladly help assist her, because we knew how undaunting and how overwhelming this must have been. And she had that look, you know, and just the way her body motion was, you know, describing this whole thing, it seemed like she was carrying, you know, a huge weight on her shoulders above and beyond anything
that
she thought the job would entail.
I just think it's really awesome that you volunteer to help go through the backlog of existing documented sites and locations, because once that's all, you know, taken out of boxes, what had been stuffed
hidden
for 5 years, whatever, then she will be so much better able to do her job, because then when someone comes from the Aupua'a of Olohena, or from the Aupua'a of Waipole,
or
Kamalu Malo'o, wherever it is, she can say, oh, okay, well, let me check my records. Oh, yes, we have something right here. Oh, yes, it's right at my fingertips. Yes, we need to go out there and take a look at that. And then she can be helping to preserve historic sites, which is
exactly
Fantastic.
And that's what we were trying to do, is like, you know, girl, that's your job. Yours shouldn't be where you're actually behind a desk as some, you know, librarian kind of document and sort and do all this stuff. And I think we've only gotten maybe halfway through so far.
Yeah, I don't think you're that far.
Amount.
No.
Yeah, if that.
Yeah, I don't think
you know,
so.
I mean, literally, there's a lot to go.
Yeah. No, I saw the pile.
You know?
So,
did you?
Yeah.
Oh,
so
okay,
I just want to thank you for doing that, and it's my secret hope that through having talked with you about this on the air, that other listeners who are interested in doing a very similar thing would be so moved to give Mary Jane Naone, Kauai lead archaeologist at the State Historic Preservation Division, an email and volunteer to help as well.
Well, what this is also doing in the long run is for all of us on the island of Kauai, we'll then be able to access this as a resource for ourselves, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it is all public information.
Yeah.
But it has to be sorted out
right
before it can be put downloaded and onto files, so then in the future, anybody in the general public can access this information, and it's not stuffed in a box that was wrapped up in, you know, Burger King napkins or something like that.
Right, right, right.
You know, and just thrown, like you said, to the wayward side.
Well, I just
here, figure it out.
I just wanted to thank you so much for doing that, and just kind of use you as a concrete example of somebody doing this thing. And so what I would like to do is, what I told Mary Jane Naone is I would help coordinate some volunteers to come in and help go through these boxes and stuff. So if anybody is interested in helping, I guess it's like mouth-to-mouth resuscitation with this huge volume of information that's been archived and hidden away and making it accessible and useful on our day-to-day basis, you can please give me an email at jjkawaii@gmail.com. That's the letter J for Jonathan, the second letter J for J, jjkawaii@gmail.com. And sometime in August or September, we're going to coordinate some teams of volunteers to go over there and help shovel through this big, huge backlog of documents. So thank you, Tim Kalai. Really appreciate that. You're a noble individual, and I hope that your actions have inspired others, because they certainly have inspired me.
Once again, and that's all what it's about, my brother. You know, we all are part of this island, and if we can make somebody do their job more efficiently, and especially somebody on that level as Mary Jane, you know, that's what's important. Not, once again, shuffling papers in a back office. It's really our kuleana, you know, about helping and supporting somebody that's come new to this island. You know, and to me, that's what it means to be
you know, part of being a Kauaian, if I'm going to put it that, you know?
Yeah, Kauaian.
That we help each other.
Sure.
That's what it's about. And it's not just for payolas, and it's not for this, it's not for that. Yeah, I could have been working and doing other things, but you know what? Oh, when I looked at that pile initially, I just said, my God. I could understand why her eyes were rolling in the back of her head as she was talking about how monumental the task was that was before her, you know? And so, and on top of that, to have a 60-hour work week,
yeah,
you know, while going through that, I said, girl, this is going to take you a decade, you know, if you do it at this pace.
Well, if we all chip in, we could probably get it done before the end of the year.
Yes, and I look forward to getting back to that. Once again, you know, sometimes life calls on its own duties where you got to just deal with Ohana first. And
Performing Arts Center, and the film will begin at 4.
Oh, I cannot wait. Cannot wait.
Yeah.
You know?
You plus one. And not only you, but also I just want to also thank Victoria Dietrich, Debbie Petrunchak, I hope I'm saying that right, and Jennifer Anthony. They all called in and were able to explain that Aina means not just land, but that which feeds us. So I wanted to let you guys know the phone lines are open now. Thank Mr. Tim for calling in. 826-7771. We've got about maybe 12 more minutes left in the hour here, and I wanted to make a couple of announcements on things that are coming up that you might be interested in to know more about. We've got Kaloa Plantation Days from July 17th to the 26th. So I guess that's already begun. Let's see, Friday is tomorrow? No, wait. What week are we here? There we go. Today's the 23rd. All right, so Friday, there is stuff going on at Mahaulepu, and there's a watercolor class. There's going to be Old Kaloa Town Historical Walk. Saturday's a big day. That's the annual parade. So that's going to start at 10 a.m. in Kaloa Town, and it's going to be a big celebration at the park. It's a lot of fun if you've ever been to that. It's totally worth checking out. Please do that. Do that. And you want to find information out, it's at KaloaPlantationDays.com. That's K-O-L-O-A, Kaloa, Plantation Days with an S, .com. Also, we've got Hei Moku Hei Va'a, Climate Change and a Call to Action. This is an event that's going to be a panel discussion put together by for an hour from 6 to 7, and then from 7 to 8, they're going to have breakout with questions. And after they sort of do an education round, then they're going to open up the discussion for what can we do about it. And that's actually the most exciting thing. It's so exciting that KKCR is going to be there, and we're going to broadcast that event live. So that's Wednesday, the 29th next week from 6 to 8 p.m. instead of the normal, I think it's the King Zor show. King Zor has graciously allowed this event to be broadcast. He's taken the night off, an evening of well-deserved rest and repose for Mr. Zor, King Zor, Ray Zor, who does a fantastic show. And I imagine that he's going to be all pumped up and ready to blow out a super-duper, what do they call that? Fragilistic expialidocious show on the coming week next Wednesday. So yeah, KKCR will broadcast this. Hei Moku, Hei Va'a, the island as a canoe. And you know, you got to put all your paddles in at the same time or else you're never going to get anywhere. Speaking of all the paddles in at the same time, wanted to let you know that big events are continuing to unfold and evolve over on Mauna Kea, White Mountain, or Mauna a Vakea, the Mountain of Vakea. It's a father sky deity in the Hawaiian Genesis creation saga. Mauna Kea is the astonishing mountain that stands in the calm. And if you've been following events there for the last 120 days or so, you know a little bit about the international consortium backed by the billionaires who want to create a 30-meter telescope. It's 100 feet in diameter, and it's It would be the largest telescope in the world. There's only a couple of good locations to plant it on the Northern Hemisphere. Mauna Kea is one because it has such excellent visibility there. The skies are so clear. The air is so dry. The wind is so calm. The air is so thin. It makes a great place to observe from. But, you know, there's already more than a dozen telescopes up there. So when people talk about compromising, hey, take those other telescopes down if this one's so much better, and then we can talk about it. Or, you know, if you don't want to do that, put your telescope somewhere else. The Gran Canary Islands is another great location in the Northern Hemisphere. The Europeans have some nice multi-segment telescopes up there. I'm sure they'd be very happy to host the TMT, the 30-meter telescope, because as big as a 1.4 billion-dollar telescope is, it doesn't begin to approach. It's minuscule in comparison to a 10,000-meter temple, which is what Mauna Kea is. And, you know, astronomers, they, like, every day is Christmas up on the summit of Mauna Kea, so they just want more and more and more. The only thing, it's not their mountain. So, and it doesn't, I should say, I love astronomy. I think it's amazing. I think it's one of the staggering human achievements of Western civilization. But it's not as impressive to me as the Polynesian culture's discovery of how to live sustainably, because as wonderful as Western science is and Western technology and even the gear that it used to make this radio broadcast right here, right now, we haven't figured out how to make this stuff fly. We haven't figured out how to make it keep going. So there's wisdom in other cultures that the West would do well to humbly learn from. That's what I try and do in my life when I see that there are people who are wiser than I am, who have more experience than I am, who understand things that I don't understand. So this Mauna Kea event, it's an amazing opportunity for people to come together and discover a brand new level of understanding. You know, it's a wonderful thing to look for life on other planets, but you've got to start here. You can't trample on life here because you want to see something 125 light years away. You can't trample on other people. You can't refuse to recognize their humanness while you're reaching for the stars. We got one caller calling in. Going to put you on and get you straight on to the airwaves. Aloha caller, welcome to Out of the Box. Thank you so much for calling in and tuning in and listening.
Thank you. I just was wondering, was that chemtrails this afternoon that we saw everywhere spreading out in Kapaa?
No idea.
Just was wondering because it covered the whole sky for a while.
I have no idea.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you guys are my go-to people, so I'm not going to worry again.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. Appreciate that.
Thank you. Bye.
So I think that If anyone else would like to call in, 826-7771, real fast, make a quick comment. We got time for just you. You are the last caller for today. Aloha, caller. Thank you so much for sharing your afternoon with us. What is on your mind? Are you there, caller? Aloha, caller.
Hello.
There you go. You're the last caller for the day. And then
I just grabbed it because the other guy wasn't there. Yes, those were chemtrails. They were everywhere.
I don't understand chemtrails. Can you explain them to me? How can you look at a cloud in the sky with a chemtrail detector gun, and how do you know it's a chemtrail? What makes it a chemtrail?
Because they all look the same, and they feather out, and they're unique, like tic-tac-toe designs. And then once that starts spreading out, it's like a spider web. And now they're adding little mirrored pieces of metallic, like real thin pieces of aluminum foil, so that they are carried in the atmosphere longer, and they reflect more, and it's nasty stuff.
So how do you distinguish visually between a chemtrail and a contrail?
Well, a chemtrail, you can see where they start just off the reef on Kapa'a Town. There's nothing, and then all of a sudden there's this line that starts, and it goes over the island to Waimea, and then it stops. And it's one straight line, you know, and it'll start arcing and melting and dripping, and then there's one alongside of it that does the same thing. You can see where they start right off the reef outside Kapa'a Town.
Well, I have to confess that I really don't understand chemtrails.
Well, I think they have to do with geoengineering, which creates droughts, which allows GM companies to have more of a drought area, so they have the exact kind of conditions they need to experiment on drought-resistant seed. So that has a lot to do with it.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right.
Aloha.
Aloha. Well, that's about all the time we have for this show today, but coming up is Dove and his metaphysical evolve. He never knows what he's going to play, and that's kind of what makes it exciting. If you have information about chemtrails and you're willing to patiently walk me through your understandings, I'd be very happy to learn a little bit more about that. Quite frankly, I'm skeptical, but there's all kinds of things that I'll know about, and I'm always willing to learn more. I want to thank you guys so much for tuning in today. It was a fantastic show. Really appreciate all the calls. Hope that you guys are stoked to go see this upcoming movie and the upcoming broadcast that we're going to be doing, and the great events that are going to be happening across the island with Dr. Stephanie Senhoff and Dr. Carmen. A lot of information to share. So coming up next is Dove with Evolve, and we're going to go out with some of this really kooky Chemical Brothers. Aloha and ahui ho, ma lama pono.